If you follow New York Times journalist and Pulitzer Prize winner Nicole Hannah-Jones on Twitter, you may have noticed her official Twitter name is not her own. Online, she goes as Ida Bae Wells, an homage to one of the most influential women in American history. Or perhaps you walk down Gold Street in Brooklyn and realize there's also a sign there now that says Ida B. Wells Place, as of about a year ago, because the crusading journalists and activists lived there once upon a time. Ida B. Wells was born on July 16, 1862, to enslaved parents living in Holly Springs, Mississippi. She was the oldest of eight children, and just before she turned 3 years old, the Civil War ended. Ida B. Wells grew up to become one of the most powerful black women of her time. She is perhaps best known as an anti-lynching activist and journalist, shedding light on the most disturbing crimes committed against black people and speaking about her findings around the country. She was also a businesswoman, an NAACP co-founder, a feminist and a suffragette, a mother and a wife. In 2020, Ida B. Wells was posthumously given a special citation for a Pulitzer Prize for her outstanding and courageous reporting on the horrific and vicious violence against African Americans during the era of lynching. It's no wonder Nicole Hannah-Jones honors her every day on Twitter. Here to tell us more about the life of Ida B. Wells is her great-granddaughter, writer Michelle Duster. She is the author of a new book, Ida B. the Queen, The Extraordinary Life and Legacy of Ida B. Wells. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me, Allison.
So you start the book with a story of how the FBI was aware and concerned about Ida B. Wells. Let me get to page one so I can read a little bit of this correspondence. It says, We have on file quite a few reports from different cities where she has addressed meetings of colored people and endeavored to impress upon them that they are a downtrodden race and now is the time for them to demand and secure their proper position in the world. She is a very effective speaker, and her influence among the colored race is well recognized. I believe she is considered by all of the intelligence officers as one of the most dangerous Negro agitators, and it would seem that her case should be considered very carefully before she is given a passport to the peace conference. Why was that a good story to start this book?
Oh, wow. Well, I wanted to start the story off with just to give perspective of how much power she had and how she was regarded by the government of the United States. I personally found that very intriguing, and I just wanted to kind of encapsulate the extent of her influence.
What did she accomplish that put her on the Intelligence Bureau's radar? What was it they were so very concerned about?
Well, what they were investigating her for at that particular time was that she was protesting against the government of the United States because there had been a mass lynching of soldiers, of African-American soldiers in Houston. And so they found it unbelievable that she would, you know, criticize the government. So that, I think, is what started them investigating her. And they found, you know, more as far as her sphere of influence when it came to advocating for African-American rights.
When you were growing up, I think all little kids like to hear about their grandparents and their great-great-grandparents. When did you first realize, oh my goodness, my great-grandmother was this extraordinary person outside of being my great-grandmother? And how was she a presence in your life?
Well, my great-grandmother, Ida B. Wells, passed away 32 years before I was born, so I never met her. So I learned about her through my grandmother, who was her youngest daughter. And my grandmother would tell us about her mother, but she also, you know, shielded us, meaning my brothers and my cousins and I, from the level of danger and violence that my great-grandmother faced. So she was presented to us as somebody who fought for freedom and equality.
What was something you learned about Ida B. Wells through your research that actually kind of became news to you and your family?
Well, that's what I started the book with, because I knew that she was a journalist, and she, you know, had advocated for, and she exposed lynching as a form of domestic terrorism, and she had been involved in the suffrage movement. But I did not know that she had been investigated by the FBI, and I just found that so amazing that I wanted to start the book that way.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about her early life a little bit. What do we know about her parents, James and Elizabeth Wells?
Well, her parents were born, they were enslaved for most of their lives, as well as obviously previous generations to that. So her father was a carpenter and her mother was a cook. They were working together in the home in Holly Springs, Mississippi. And unfortunately, both of them died within a day of each other in 1878 from a yellow fever epidemic, leaving Ida and her siblings as orphans.
And she was only 16 when her parents died, and her youngest brother, of yellow fever at the same time. And she went to extraordinary lengths to keep the family together, to keep the siblings together. What responsibilities did she have after this tragedy, and how did she try to keep the family together?
Well, I mean, she had to make a living in order to support her five younger siblings. So she secured a job as a teacher in a rural school in Mississippi. And I learned later on that her grandmother actually helped her. Her father's mother helped take care of the children while she was working. But so that actually added even more, because then she was taking care of herself, her grandmother, and her five siblings.
You know, you mentioned that she was a teacher. I think people know the activist, journalist, suffragette part of her life. But as an educator, did her role as an educator and an activist ever intersect?
Yes. There was a period in when she was teaching in Memphis when she protested or shed light on the inequalities within the school systems. They were separate and unequal, and she lost her job as a result of criticizing that.
Was there something about the way that James and Elizabeth raised her and the values that they stressed that it makes sense that she would be someone that would become an activist, that would be someone who would speak up?
Well, from what she wrote in her autobiography about the way that she was raised, was her father was very involved in politics. He took advantage of the newly secured right to vote, and he actually lost his carpentry shop after he voted the opposite of the way his former master had requested. So he was willing to stand up for himself, even though he ended up losing his business, but he rebuilt.
My guest is Michelle Duster. We're talking about her book, Ida B. the Queen, The Extraordinary Life and Legacy of Ida B. Wells. Ida B. Wells is Michelle's great-grandmother. So you write about this really interesting story when Ida is on a train heading from Memphis to Woodstock, and she is tossed off the car for refusing to move to a newly segregated car when she had already purchased a first-class ticket. How did she use this as an opportunity to fight for change, to activate her activism?
Well, she sued the railroad on the basis of separate and unequal. And she originally won the case, but then it was overturned a couple of years later. But she also wrote about the incident in newspapers to highlight the inequality.
Would you read a little bit? You include in the book, this is some of the greatest stuff in the book, is a particular entry about this event that she wrote. Would you mind reading that for us?
Yes. So she wrote, Ida B. Wells wrote in her journal at the time, "The Supreme Court reversed the decision of the lower court in my behalf last week. Went to see Judge Greer this afternoon, and he tells me four of them cast their personal prejudices in the scale of justice and decided in face of all the evidence to the contrary that the smoking car was a first-class coach for colored people as provided for by that statute that calls for separate coaches but first class for the races. I felt so disappointed because I had hoped such great things for my suit, for my people generally. I firmly believed all along that the law was on our side and would, when we appealed to it, give us justice. I feel shorn of that belief and utterly discouraged. And just now, if it were possible, would gather my race in my arms and fly far away with them. Oh God, is there no redress, no peace, no justice in this land for us? Thou hast always fought for the battles of the weak and oppressed. Come to my aid at this moment and teach me what to do, for I am sorely, bitterly disappointed. Show us the way, even as thou led the children of Israel out of bondage into the promised land.
How was this disillusionment with the legal system a turning point for her?
I think she realized at that particular time that there was no way to get justice through the legal system, because the law said that accommodations should be separate and equal, and it was obvious that they were unequal. And so she decided at that point to appeal to the court of public opinion versus dealing with the legal system.
When she first became a journalist, what was her focus before she began writing about lynching?
Oh, she was writing about a lot of different topics. They were mostly social issues and what would be considered hard news today. And so that was her focus. That was what she was interested in writing versus what most women were sort of encouraged to write about, which women's issues like child rearing, decoration, fashion. She wanted to write about social issues and politics and justice.
Most people, I think, know her as a pioneer of investigative journalism with her work around lynchings throughout the country. How did she go about her work? Was there something particularly innovative about the kind of journalism she did at the time? How did she get this work published?
Well, she co-owned the newspaper, the Memphis Free Speech. And when she first started what is now called data journalism, she was going around and investigating lynchings that took place. And she was collecting names, dates, locations, and the reasons why people were lynched. And in order to compile all of this information into what would be considered basically trying a case in the court of public opinion. And that was very unusual for somebody to do that at that time.
When you're doing that kind of work, it's, of course, you're going to anger people, especially when you're doing work around lynching. When was a time when her life was in direct danger as the result of her work?
In 1892, after her three of her friends were killed because they were enterprising grocery store owners, she advocated for people to boycott the streetcars in Memphis and boycott white-owned businesses. And as a result, her life was threatened.
In her work, you know, part of what her work did was illuminate what was really happening around lynchings. How did her reporting counter the narrative around lynchings that you might read in a white-owned newspaper?
Well, the narrative at that time was that the prevailing narrative was that black men were violating white women, and they were sort of framed as bestial people who, you know, deserved to be killed because they were so dangerous. And what my great grandmother uncovered was that if there were liaisons, and they were mostly consensual, most of the time they were consensual, but a great majority of the time, if a crime was committed, it was very minor. But a lot of times it was the person was not guilty of any crime. They were leaders in the community. And so lynching was being used as a form of domestic terrorism.
My guest is Michelle Duster. We're talking about her book and her great-grandmother. Ida B. The Queen, The Extraordinary Life and Legacy of Ida B. Wells. Before Ida moved to Chicago, she did spend some time here in New York, living in Brooklyn. She became one-fourth co-owner of the New York Age newspaper, a Black-owned publication. What do we know about the work she did here in New York with the New York Age?
When she first moved to New York, after her friends were killed and her printing press was destroyed in Memphis, she was so outraged by what happened that she wrote a series of articles in the New York Age that chronicled what was happening in the South when it came to lynching. She wanted people in the North to know the level of terror that was taking place in the South. And she eventually compiled those articles into a pamphlet called Southern Horrors, Lynch Law and All Its Phases.
It's very interesting. In the book, we read about her. She's this activist. She's this dynamic speaker. But you take a point in the book, this little sidebar, that she loved fashion. And you write that she lusted after having pretty dresses made and obtaining hats and matching parasols. She found herself in debt at times in order to satisfy her desire for fine clothes and paid for them in installments. Why did you want to tell us about that?
So in Ida B. The Queen, I really wanted to help humanize my great-grandmother and help people understand that she wasn't, I mean, even though she achieved all of these amazing things, mm-hmm. I mean, it's just an awe-inspiring level of accomplishment. She also was just like us. You know, she liked to shop and she liked to look nice. And I also wanted to incorporate how she sometimes had doubted herself. And sometimes she felt lonely and sometimes she was frustrated. That was what appealed to me when I was trying to figure out, like, who is this woman that I'm related to and how can I relate to her? Mm-hmm. And so those things for me made her human.
It's interesting you should say that. This brings me to my next question, because you've written that Vice President Kamala Harris's relationship with her husband, Doug, reminds you a bit of Ida's relationship with her husband, lawyer Ferdinand L. Burnett. How did Ida and Ferdinand support one another in their work?
They actually worked very well together. I mean, they made a good team where he was an attorney. And obviously she was a civil rights activist. Mm-hmm. And so he would use his legal knowledge and compile information for her to build sort of like a case. And then she was the one who would go and present the information in front of, you know, different boards of people to argue cases. There were several situations where she went and testified in front of governors of Illinois in particular in order to advocate for justice and equality.
Her list of accomplishments are extraordinary. She co-founded the National Association of Colored Women in 1896. She integrated the Washington, D.C. Suffragette March. She was one of the co-founders of the NAACP. She met with two presidents during her lifetime, William McKinley in 1898 and Woodrow Wilson in 1913, the latter a well-known racist. What do we know about how those meetings went?
Well, the only sources I have are really her writings, where she recounted those meetings. And basically, the presidents were cordial and basically were like, well, we'll think about it. We'll look into it. And then nothing happened.
What did she do in the face of when nothing happened? What was her go-to after something like that? Or if an organization, like at one point, she kind of becomes disenchanted with the NAACP. What does she do in those moments?
Well, I mean, what she did with Woodrow Wilson was she and William Monroe Trotter continued working together on the National Equal Rights League in order to continue to affect change. I mean, she did protest the government that Woodrow Wilson was president at the time when the soldiers were killed by their own government. So, I mean, she still used her own form of protest.
And it's interesting, I'm glad you brought up protest, because in the book, there's all these really terrific illustrations, and you intersperse stories of other activists, people like Adam Clayton Powell Jr., and then someone like Bree Newsom and Colin Kaepernick. Why did you want to structure the book this way?
I really wanted people to not only learn about my great-grandmother's work and legacy, but also understand the strategies that she used in order to impact change, and how those same strategies have been used since she passed away by numerous individual people as well as organizations.
And when you think about it, it's interesting. You make a point that your grandmother didn't really talk about Ida B. Wells as Ida B. Wells, the icon, but as a mom. So what did she tell you about her as a mom?
My grandmother, pretty much, she did focus on what her mother did professionally, but she mostly passed down values that she learned from her mom as far as, you know, we need to speak up for ourselves, to always, you know, not be intimidated by anybody, to, know that education is a source of power, those type of things that she really kind of emphasized.
The name of the book is Ida B. the Queen, The Extraordinary Life and Legacy of Ida B. Wells. It is by Michelle Duster. Michelle, thank you so much for being with us.